I'm called many things by the left because of my viewpoints. But the only thing that they really love to trot out over and over again is that I'm Father Coughlin. Most people don't even know who that is, but you need to know
who
he is.
The contest stands between the forces of the Jew, Karl Marx, and the forces of the Jew, Jesus Christ. You must choose one or the other.
I'm Mark Levitt, and welcome to Action Speaks, Underappreciated Dates That Changed America, produced by AS220 with funding from the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities and Johnson & Wales University. Our presenting radio station is 89.7 WGBH Boston, and we are now heard on over 250 radio stations throughout the United States. We're taping tonight from the cafe at AS220 in Down City, Providence, Rhode Island, home of Triple Deckers, Artists and Lofts, and the confluence of the not-quite-so-mighty Woonasquatucket and Providence Rivers. Today, our topic is the first radio broadcasts in 1926 of Father Charles Edward Coughlin, radio's first conservative host and a man who paved the airwaves for today's ubiquitous and highly influential conservative radio and television personalities. On today's AM radio airwaves that burn with the red-hot intensity of an ideological bonfire, conservative radio hosts fuel an anger that has helped bring forth the Tea Party and the evangelical right. Since Barack Obama's election, this anger, along with that of the blogs and Fox News, has not only given birth to rumors about the president's place of birth, but also questions about his patriotism and the direction of his policies and where they might lead. In the 1930s, another president was continually under attack by a radio host, one whose message reached at one time or another an estimated 30 to 40 million people, and whose voice could be heard from the windows of houses, apartments, and tenements on every American street. And yet this man, unlike today's conservative media stars, was once a supporter of his president. And again, unlike today's conservative hosts, was a man of the cloth, a priest, originally from Canada, who moved to Royal Oak, Michigan, and began in 1926 an empire built through the use of a new media, one that was helping to weave a national identity from the invisible threads of radio waves. The man, Father Charles Edward Coughlin, the possessor of, as the author Wallace Stegner once said, a voice made for promises.
I am nothing more, gentlemen, than a friendly critic and exponent of what I believe to be the sound principles of Christianity and Americanism. I want labor to succeed. I want unionism to succeed, but I want them to succeed within the structure of our Americanism and our Christianity.
Who was Father Coughlin, and what was his role in creating today's conservative media lineup? What lessons can we learn from the rise and fall of radio's most popular priest? Was he truly, as was charged, anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi? Have we gone too far in allowing our media hosts to say virtually anything they want in the pursuit of ratings and of a political agenda?
In fact, he was quite slippery. So he's a Roosevelt supporter, and then he's not. And he's a supporter of all other religions, and then he's not. And he's a let's all work together, and the rich will help the poor, and then he's not. And I think that's in some ways what goes on today.
How come you want to connect Glenn Beck to him? That somehow today's conservative talk radio is the direct descendant of this anti-Semitic bastard. And that is not an accurate connection.
Part of his appeal was similar to Roosevelt's appeal in that they could identify villains, Wall Street, you know, international gold brokers, communists.
His broadcasts precede Roosevelt's fireside chats. They precede the use of the radio by Goebbels in Nazi Germany. He understood, I think, before most people, how radio could reach that vast audience.
To help us find answers to these and many other questions, our panelists today are Dr. Susan Smullyan, professor in the Department of American Civilization, Brown University, and the author of two books, Selling Radio, The Commercialization of American Broadcasting and Popular Ideologies, Mass Culture at Mid-Century. Michael Harrison, publisher of Talk Magazine. Dr. Sheldon Marcus, professor in the Division of Educational Leadership and Policy at Fordham University's Graduate School of Education, and the author of Father Coughlin, The Tumultuous Life of the Priests of the Little Flower, and Dr. Evelyn Stern, associate professor at the University of Rhode Island, the director of graduate studies, and the author of Ballots and Bibles, Ethnic Politics, and the Catholic Church in Providence. Sheldon Marcus, you are the last remaining biographer of Father Coughlin. Tell us about how you met the good father and what your interpretation of him was.
I met Father Coughlin eventually after trying for a very, very long period of time to interview him for a book for which I already had a contract. And I had failed miserably until I interviewed the daughter of the editor of his weekly newspaper, Social Justice. She said she hadn't seen him in decades, and besides which, I wouldn't need an interview, I wouldn't need help, because if I went out to where he lived, I knew where he lived, and waited by the garbage, when he took out the garbage, if I stepped forward and introduced myself, he would invite me in for coffee. At that point, I was ready to do that, but I thought I would give him one last chance. So I wrote him a letter that began with the following words. Dear Father Coughlin, I've been devoting a number of years to compiling a biography of you, and I think it's only fit and proper that you give me a couple of hours of your time. I got a call at my office at Fordham, and some voice said to me, Dr. Marcus, and I came to attention because I thought Franklin Roosevelt had somehow picked up the phone and called me. And he said, this is Father Coughlin. When can you come out?
Susan Smullyan, Father Coughlin has quite a reputation and quite a role in the history of radio. As a radio historian, how do you understand Father Coughlin and his effect on radio?
Religion on the radio happened very early, so that radio stations who were looking to fill up time thought, well, this is a good idea. We'll just take microphones out to churches. They're already doing stuff. We can put that on the air really easily. And so they did. And then various religious personality, people who wanted to speak on the radio, began to just ask for time, and the stations would give them time. And Father Coughlin was one of these. And eventually, he became so controversial that the regular station said, and at this point, by this point, at the end of the 20s, the stations were organized into networks, and CBS said, no, you can't come in every week. So that's in 1931, I think. Is that right? Something like that. They said, you know, we just don't have time for this anymore, but really he was too controversial. So Coughlin gathered a group of stations together, paid the money, and raised money by asking for donations on the radio, and bought time on a series of stations, and really in some ways was most popular when he went off the major networks and started his own network. So it was important because it was someone who could start their own network and still be heard. It was important because there were boundaries, it turns out, of what kind of speech was the networks were going to allow on the radio. And it was important because it was a moment at which political and religious talk comes into the home in a way that it hadn't before.
And listen to how prescient he was. This is, I think, when he began to understand the power of radio. He says, when one thinks of the hundreds of miles traveled by St. Paul along the coastal cities of Greece, when one visualizes historically the hundreds of converts which he drew to Christ through his indefatigable labors, he cannot but know the potential good which can be accomplished by his successors who are making use of God's latest gift to man, the radio. The radio is the modern medium, a of preaching the gospel to all nations. Michael Harrison, such a forward thinker in using the radio, how come Glenn Beck wants to distance himself from him?
How come you want to connect Glenn Beck to him?
Well, how come people do want to connect him to him? Good question. You answer that. You're the expert.
No, you have to answer it, because it seems to me that the entire panel began on a biased note that somehow today's conservative talk radio is the direct descendant of this anti-Semitic bastard. And that is not an accurate connection any more than to say that radio is somehow responsible for the many different messages that are on it anymore. Why not blame microphones? Why not blame the air itself? So I think that as we have this discussion, I will try to defend the First Amendment and defend the many good people on the left, center, and right who labor under very difficult conditions in a very different time, in a very different society, and in a very different media landscape than existed in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, with very different issues too, and try to come out of it presenting an objective view without getting into a left or right, black or white conversation, which I very dangerously could wind up seeming to defend this contemptible character.
Well, tell me the truth, though. You don't actually think there's any linkage at all, not necessarily ideological, but in the use of radio for political purposes and the way awareness.
And I welcome that. I think it's wonderful.
Well,
that
I'm
in
not
America,
judging it. I'm
we,
just curious
yes,
whether
of course the radio is used for ideological purposes, and that's good. The fact of the matter is that radio is just one of many tools that is used to carry out the marketplace of free ideas, same as books. And radio plays a very fundamental role in carrying that out.
But perhaps you're getting ahead of yourself, because I don't think there has been, at this point, necessarily an ideological bias about him. And I think perhaps you've been on other panels when maybe there has been ideological bias trying to link Father Coughlin and the hate speech of what some people consider hate speech of radio connected. That remains to be seen whether we go in that direction or not.
Well, I think we already went in that direction based upon when you listen back to the opening of this program. You made a very, very clear-cut connection between Father Coughlin being the father of today's hateful conservative talk radio, and you presented Glenn Beck as that. Now, I'm not defending Glenn Beck. He might be hateful. I don't necessarily agree with what he's saying, but that's a far jump from a fellow like Glenn Beck to this character, Father Coughlin. They are light years apart in terms of the size of their audience, the nature of the impact they had upon America's position in the world and what was about to come, the enemy that was looming on the horizon at that time in the form of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, and it's a comparison that has to be contested. And that's all I'm doing at the very outset.
Well, let's in fact get into exactly what Father Coughlin talked about. Eve Stern, Father Coughlin seems to have been affected by a couple of the orders coming from Pope Pius. What were those orders and what was their ideological components?
Catholics were told, starting around the turn of the 20th century, to very carefully avoid any sort of militant labor action. So avoid the IWW, avoid socialism, and definitely, by all means, avoid communism, but embrace progressive social action, embrace mainstream unionism, embrace progressive economic policy. So Father Coughlin was speaking for a broader trend in American Catholicism when he raised valid critiques about concentration of wealth and a growing class gap, a growing gap between the haves and have-nots. And so he was raising some very real issues, and he was speaking to larger trends in not only American Catholicism, but worldwide Catholicism coming from Rome.
Shelley Marcus, when you spoke to Father Coughlin, did he reveal his interest in the class structure and in the problems of the division of wealth, which he articulated during the 1930s?
The Catholic Church is not monolithic. So, for example, in his heyday, he was a priest under two Pope Piuses, Pope Pius the 11th and Pope Pius the 12th. And certainly the push to implement social justice was very, very heavy. Yet Coghlan built his first church with non-union labor, although he did not pay them minimum wage, but he didn't pay them union wage either. But in terms of economics, there's the what he told the public and then what he does for himself. For example, publicly he's advocating a return to the silver standard. Privately, he's the largest owner of silver shares in the state of Michigan. So obviously there was a benefit if his policy that he was advocating was actually implemented.
But I think that I think hypocrisy is basically part of any public speaker's or politician's behavior. I just think that that's a given, and that's sort of not exactly a way in which we could get into his appeal and why he was, unless people like con artists, which might be the case. Susan Smullyan, what do you think was Father Coghlan's appeal? Because he started out kind of giving sermons of the heart and sermons about Catholicism. And then later, he actually took this idea of social action and merged it with this more religiously oriented conviction to the point where he was supporting Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the election against Hoover.
Right. I mean, what's interesting to me about Coghlan and where I think the comparison is interesting to people in the media today is, in fact, he was quite slippery as you're trying to pin down his ideological beliefs. So he's a Roosevelt supporter, and then he's not. And he's a supporter of all other religions, and then he's not. And he's a let's all work together and, you know, be one big nation, and the rich will help the poor, and then he's not. And so there's a way in which he moves among positions that's not utterly consistent. But I think his audience found it interesting to see how all these different ideas that they heard talked about get processed through this one brain. And I think that's in some ways what goes on today. I mean, I don't think Glenn Beck, just to choose one person, is utterly consistent. And it's really interesting. There's this strain of populism on the right where it's like, well, you know, we want workers to have more rights and more money. And on the other hand, there's a strain of real hard right-wing approaching fascism, I sometimes feel in some talk radio people. So I find the comparison quite apt in some ways, not because I want to say that everybody on the radio and television today is anti-Semitic, but because Coghlan did this funny dance through a range of different ideas that Americans have held dear at different times, and he sort of hits them all, and that's what makes him popular.
Number six, let's hear what he says about the money counters.
All you poor laborers and farmers, we have tried time and again to tell you that there can be no resurrection for America until Congress begins to coin and regulate the value of money. We have endeavored to teach you time and again that there can be no coming out of this depression until what you earn goes to sustain your wife and your children. But somehow or other you're satisfied to sustain the wives and children of those who do the coining and regulating of money, who live in their palaces and travel in their yachts. You want that. You voted for that. You have that. And it's time that you take that.
So, Eve Stern, is this consistent, this sort of railing against the, quote, the international bankers at the same time railing against communists? Is this middle ground that you're talking about that sort of dominated his ideology?
Yes, in the sense that both are these internationalist doctrines that were troubling to Americans who were trying to hold on to localism and feeling threatened by impersonal forces beyond their control. There were so many others, too. You know, corporatization, consolidation, international banking, communism, and those two in particular were often thinly veiled anti-Semitism. So here you see the beginnings of how he started this dangerous trajectory toward anti-Semitism. And I think, you know, just connecting that question to your earlier question about his appeal, I think part of his appeal was similar to Roosevelt's appeal, in that they were able to articulate in rather vague terms this sense of malaise people were feeling, but without being precise enough to, you know, get themselves in trouble for, you know, articulating a very precise economic theory that could be disproven. They could identify villains, Wall Street, you know, international gold brokers, communists, but there wasn't anything specific. But it was general enough to give people something to hold on to.
Let's listen briefly to another genius of the airwaves, a fireside chat of FDR, talking about exactly what you're saying, mm-hmm. some of these issues of confidence and courage and the economy itself. Mm-hmm.
Confidence and courage are the essentials of success in carrying out our plan. You people must have faith. Let us unite in banishing fear. We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system, and it is up to you to support and make it work. It is your problem, my friends. Your problem no less than it is mine. Together, we cannot fail.
Michael Harrison, do you see a connection at all with the delivery of Roosevelt and Coughlin and today's talk show hosts?
No, it's interesting you ask that question. You'll hear a distinct difference in the delivery of the 30s. My friends, I am here to tell you.
You could tell he was a radio host,
it would
too.
Sound, it would sound comical. That was because in those days, there were fewer channels of communication, and the person was very much like a stage performer as opposed to a film performer. On the media, you were literally talking from a mountaintop to an entire nation that was sitting and looking at the radio. Imagine, they actually looked at the radio, sat in their living rooms and looked at this big piece of furniture, and they imagined you talking to them, the one to the many. Over the years, the media has become more channels, smaller audiences, more channels. So it's become more one-on-one.
I was telling to chime in. That's a very, very accurate description, because I must tell you that the broadcasts that Father Coughlin delivered emanated from the top of the church tower. So indeed, he was on high when he delivered his Sunday talks.
It's also true that the radio style in some ways came to seem very masculine, that men had the right voices to be announcers. So Michael gets to have a radio voice. And you would never say that about me. I don't particularly have a radio voice, but you never say that about women.
Well,
women
wait a minute,
never
wait,
have radio voices.
I have a radio voice.
Right.
Let's play
so
it right
I was
now.
Gonna say, just let me set it up for a minute, that one of the things I said to Mark was that if you're gonna play Father Coughlin, you ought to play Amy Semple McPherson, who was also a famous and widely listened to religious figure on the radio, and has a very different delivery and a very different kind of voice.
In each city, they ask the same question. Sister McPherson, what do you think of prohibition? It's rather difficult to answer the question in such a few words as one must use then. But I told them that the case of our prohibition here in the United States reminds me of the story of the lecturer who gave a marvelous address on prohibition. And he wound up in a blaze of glory that brought everyone to their feet enthusiastically. Why, he said, my friends, if I had my way, do you know what I'd do? I'd take every barrel of liquor, every bottle of booze, every crate, and I'd empty it in the river. Yes, sir. Then he said, shall we now close our meeting by rising and singing together, shall we gather at the river? He'd spoiled it all. And that's the way perhaps with us over here in America. We teach it, but so often those who profess to make the laws do not quite live up to them and back them themselves.
Well, you're right. That's quite a different voice, sort of like combination of if Mary Pickford had a voice in the movies and Gracie Allen.
And there was a lot of talk on radio in the 20s and 30s about what a proper radio voice was and who was allowed to be an announcer. And women were very active as radio announcers when there wasn't much money in it. And as soon as radio took off and there was a lot more money, all of a sudden there are all these articles in the press about how a good radio voice was such and such. And funnily enough, it was always low and low-pitched and had authority, and women's voices just didn't have that, they said. But
wasn't God a man?
Yeah.
You're listening to Action Speaks. We're talking today about Father Coughlin and his effect on today's grouping of radio talk show hosts. We're from AS220 in downtown Providence, and our presenting station is 89.7 WGBH in Boston. I'm Mark Levitt. We're talking with Sheldon Marcus, Evelyn Stern, Michael Harrison, and Susan Smullyan. One thing that you mentioned, I think a couple of you mentioned, that it's really interesting. One is how people listened to radio back then. They listened to it in their living rooms, and I wonder if the expectancy of what was coming out of the radio at that time was somewhat affected by where you listened to it, where today it seems a lot of people listening to AM radio especially listen to it in their cars. More often than not, I'm sure, in the midst of a traffic jam.
Listening to radio has become a private, personal experience as opposed to a group endeavor. And to a certain degree, watching TV has too. When we used to have family night, you'd all sit in front of the TV. In those days, radio was the main electronic mass medium, and it also had a tremendous amount of magic. Just like the silver screen, the radio, television. This is very 20th century concepts. As we come into the 21st century, the magic is gone. Everybody can do a radio show from their home. Everybody's now a filmmaker.
Here's an example right here.
And as a result, it was a very, and that's why I mentioned before, it was a whole different psychological environment in terms of the performance and the listening.
But by the way, you say, and Eve, you're shaking your head. Go ahead.
I just wanted to pick up on that and say, you know, Father Coughlin would be the ultimate example of radio as community event, in that people would say his show was so popular in heavily Catholic neighborhoods in the Northeast and the Midwest. You could walk down the street on a warm evening when the windows would be open and hear his broadcast coming out of every window. You could take a walk and not miss a single word of his broadcast. So it was, in those cases, literally a community event.
But when he started, he was delivering an economic message, which, keep in mind, was very unusual for someone in the Catholic Church, because until Father Coughlin, the prevailing attitude was, you can't pay the rent, it's terrible. You have no food for your children, terrible. But keep on believing, because your reward will come in the next world. Keep also this in mind about Father Coughlin. His broadcasts precede Roosevelt's fireside chats. They precede the use of the radio by Goebbels in Nazi Germany. He understood, I think, before most people, that the radio could be used as technology had never been, well, if you go back to the printing press, obviously, but not, he understood how radio could reach that vast audience.